Yes. First of all, thank you for the organizing committee, especially Laura, for inviting me to speak about my current research. And this is the first time I am speaking in a conference about the causes of poverty. Everywhere, management of poverty we are speaking on, but this is the first time I am speaking on the causes of poverty. The title of my paper is Poverty, Policy, and Power in India, the question of employment. Why has not been the level of poverty curbed in rural areas of India? How does the rate of poverty rise over the years in rural areas, despite even the soaring growth in agriculture? Why did the economic and welfare policies that aimed at curbing poverty almost fail to reduce the level of poverty in rural West Bengal? Keeping these questions in mind, I had embarked on my research since a couple of years ago. Again and again, particularly when I did visit the rural areas of West Bengal, these questions kept haunting me to uncover a fundamental reason for the persistence of poverty in rural areas. While the years passed, I figured out that the poverty was a discursive concept created by the government, or in other words, by the state, that required managing or ruling its subjects. Actually, the poor are poor as they are unemployed or underemployed. I quickly realized that we had to understand the causes of unemployment if we were really desirous of finding some measures to get rid of poverty in rural areas. I began to alter the entire perspective of my research and framed the aforesaid questions in a different manner. Why are the rural poor unemployed? Why did the economic transformations whatsoever fail to settle the problem of rural unemployment? Despite all the efforts on the part of the government, why does the rate of unemployment rise in rural West Bengal? These inquiries brought me into a new hypothesis. I reveal that unemployment, be it the rural or the urban, is a political process, and thus the eradication of unemployment must have its roots in politics of the victims of unemployment. The confluence of three stakeholders, that is the capital, the state, and the people being classified or stratified, I argue, does create and recreate the dynamic occurrence of unemployment. My research thus reveals three key facts. First, the problem of poverty or well-being has to be understood mainly in terms of unemployment and underemployment. Second, unemployment as a political process has to be studied from the perspective of emerging politics among different constituent groups of the said process. Third, the problem of unemployment and its solution are actually a part of an interdisciplinary research agenda. Why I am saying that poverty is a discursive concept created and nurtured by the government, and that we must have to understand the dynamic nature of unemployment if we are really in want of eradicating poverty, is due not to the fact only that poverty is a conceptual category to see people from the perspective of government, and that unemployment is an empirical problem, particularly if seen from the perspective of the government. But it is due also to the fact that poverty is a governmental technology purposefully created for managing the lack of unemployment, while unemployment as experienced by the people has constantly been created as well as recreated as a consequence of both capitalist and state intervention in the domain of rural economy. If unemployment is the outcome of capitalist and state intervention in economy, poverty, whatever its level may be, is the manifestation of the phenomenon of unemployment. Thus, the interventions on the part of the government into the alleviation of poverty are nothing but a palliative attempt to lessen the agony of unemployment. It is not only an effort to lessen the pain of unemployment, but also an attempt to cover a burning social phenomenon like unemployment. The governmental discourse is so influenceable that a majority of scholarship easily often take poverty into consideration to gauge to gauge the level of well-being of the people in a particular society. Upon considering the poverty, these scholarships have not only made poverty as a perennial problem, but have made the unemployment as a default phenomenon too. Ignoring the issues of unemployment, they, in fact, turn unconcerned about the contribution of the capitalist expansion and the subsequent state intervention in creating and shaping the phenomenon of unemployment. Here lies the problem. I argue that the perspective of unemployment would not only help us to understand the causes of both unemployment and poverty, but would also offer us some possibilities to cope with these causes by way of questioning the role of capitalist expansion in creation of unemployment. To the extent that we intend to understand the role of capitalist as well as the state expansion in shaping unemployment, we would be able to find the remedy of unemployment as well as poverty. The manifestation of the deficiency of well-being, this is to say, of the effect of accumulation of capital, is generally called as poverty. The state does its politics in or manages the domain of poverty in such a way that all the concerned actors presuppose poverty as an end in itself. This is to mean we all endeavor to target the concept of poverty as both as a cause and as an effect. The real cause of poverty, it seems, has increasingly faded into oblivion. The more the governed people would become oblivious to the real root of poverty, the more the state and its institution would try to manage the issues of poverty only for the purpose of governance. As long as poverty, either as a concept or as an empirical condition, remains as a technical issue to be managed by governmental technologies, the poor would just be thought to be responsible for their own wretchedness and misery. And therefore, not only would the extent of poverty continue to increase, but also the market capitalism would remain as a default condition in all societies. So exactly has been occurred in a recent book by Banerjee and Duflo. Apart from describing the nature of poverty across the globe, poor economics, Banerjee and Duflo's book explains passionately the ways to fight global poverty. They have attempted to explore vividly the dynamic reasons why the poor are poor, and not surprisingly, to prescribe as well some steps about what is to be done to remedy the poverty. What the book has revealed throughout its pages, interestingly, is that poverty is the reason of poverty. The poor themselves are, as it were, liable for their sorry state. Thus, the poor themselves should step forward to improve their lives, and if they desire, they can undertake the lessons chalked out by the authors. Evidently, the authors are against the view of political economy, which presupposes politics has the primacy over the economics. So, there is as such no politics or class politics or the politics of capital in their world of poverty, which does play consistently in creating the issues of poverty. The authors or the poverty specialists are rather quite optimists that they identify the poverty traps armed with the present understanding why the poor live the way they do and know which tools they need to give the poor to help them get out of them. The poverty narrative of Banerjee and Duflo simply reflects the mainstream liberal thoughts with which many among the academic milieu perhaps agree. Not only does economics as a discipline conceives this kind of narrative, but the academics in other disciplines also do conceive the issues of well-being in terms of only the idea of poverty, and thus believe that eradication requires only an apolitical intervention. The class or capitalist agenda or the politics in any form never get a primacy in this narrative of capitalist development. As a result of these deliberations, John Harris argues correctly that all attention began to be directed at measurement of the incidence of poverty and its alleviation, at least to some extent, which has subsequently become a major academic industry. But the question that arises is whether the attempts which are to be directed towards the issues of poverty may at all deliver the social justices to the population. Harris, who correctly recognizes that all the policies, including the new rights agenda, are actually more about the management of poverty too holds some expectation that the policies have potential, since his argument remain in the same discursive field. It is the urgent call of the present for a departure from the dominant discursive terrain to the scholars who are seriously constructing their arguments in terms of social justice. Why I urge for a departure from this dominant discourse is actually due to the very reason that the genuine arguments in favor of social justice are incompatible with the discourses in this dominant discourse. Interestingly, like the Marxists, many such scholars who, though having a tendency to critique even the liberal way of thinking, actually are limiting their arguments to the same discursive mode. I would strongly recommend for a framework which departs from the liberal discursive level toward a new discursive level and tries to understand the issues of social justice in a newer way. The new framework intends to construct its arguments on the basis of new discourses and make sense of the current regime of hegemonic strategies. Many times, the scholars who endeavor to use the terms social justice, well-being, and poverty alleviation usually use them interchangeably. Although these terms are apparently identical, interpretation of the process is going to be complicated by the interchangeable use of the terms. It is undeniable that all these terms can be defined in a number of ways on the basis of the standpoints of different schools in social sciences. Social justice is, everyone perhaps agrees, justice in terms of the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. If this is the definition of social justice in a rational expression, it is clear that the attempts of poverty alleviation and the deliveries of social justices have their own different purpose. Almost all the social policies in India have more or less failed to deliver social justice simply due to the fact that these are only aimed at poverty alleviation. Since Professor Amurtha Sen's theory of capability approach is evidently well thought, reasonable, and focused when it defines freedom as to achieve well-being in terms of people's capabilities. This approach is broader, fine, and deeper in comparison with the established approaches which focus on economic criteria such as poverty measure and economic growth per capita. In his approach, quote, poverty is understood as deprivation in the capability to live a good life. While being solicitously defined and morally significant, Sen's approach lacks the strength to explain convincingly about the roots of unequal distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges in a particular society. We do not get any answer from his theories why some sections of a particular society are deprived from capabilities they require to live a good life, and why the people, despite having required capabilities, fail to live a good life. In fact, Sen tries to explore the meaning, means, and solution of social justice within the confines of this dominant discourse. Therefore, he inevitably reckons a standpoint wherein the capitalist development and its predicament are seen as a predetermined context which cannot be altered anyway. Instead of considering this larger perspective, Sen thus tries to understand the issues of social justice and poverty only considering the available frameworks that suited with liberal ideologies. I argue that the issues of social justice cannot be understood, leave alone to be resolved, without bestowing due importance to the root causes of injustices. Put differently, it can be understood, as Jonathan Barry asserts, only in the context of a broader analysis of the distribution of power. It must be required to know about, if one intends to address the issues of social justice, on the one hand, how the capitalist dynamics does create the deficiency of social justices, and on the other, the way the social structure influences and reshapes the nature and treatment of justices. In other words, as the issues of social justice would be inexplicable without considering the dynamic reasons of capitalist predicament, so would be its realization. India is often presumed to signify abject poverty, unemployment, and underdevelopment. Even the ideas that the economic precarity had been one of the inherent features of India, and that the British colonialists appreciatively began to cause the progress of that economy by means of initiating capitalist development, as well as expansion of the market, are also not rare, both in popular and academic discourse. I argue that Bengal, which is in miniature the history of India itself, though long been synonymous with hunger, had never a poor state. And the very moment which being considered as a beginning of modernization seemed to me the juncture at which India was intervened, devastating to its doom. The trajectories of transformation in the domain of employment have thus to be mapped ever since the period when the country was intervened by the colonial power. India and its rural, though having its own intrinsic complexities and problems, had been anything but impoverished before the British colonialists came. Take Bengal, the present West Bengal, for instance. As I have argued, several historical accounts show that its economy was the finest and most fruitful country as early as around in 1665, when, as Barnier describes, the rich exuberance of the country has given rise to a proverb in common use among the Portuguese, English, and Dutch, that the kingdom of Bengal has 100 gates open for entrance, but not one for departure. Rural unemployment. Why I am saying that the advent of British colonialism is marked as the beginning of an era is due to the fact that it introduces two simultaneous processes, as I have mentioned, that is, the capitalist transformation in rural economy and the management of the rural population through the intervention of the modern state. Two processes are, however, unsurprisingly, not at all in proportion to each other. While the extent of capitalist accumulation was aggressively overwhelming, the budding state was just setting its foot on the ground. The permanent settlement was a major intervention on the part of the British colonialists in the domain of land relations, which had transformed overwhelmingly the rural economy once for all. And the small-scale industries that began to grow sustainably in rural areas were routinely bankrupt by the violent penetration of British trade and businesses. Ever since the introduction of the permanent settlement, the condition of rural Bengal began to deteriorate in such a manner that it could not recuperate anymore. What's affected of all was the domain of employment in rural areas. The change in land rights, both proprietary and occupancy, pushed the small peasantry as well, even the rentier class, while in the late colonial period, into an economic crisis, mainly in the question of livelihoods. As the level of capitalist expansion in agriculture mounted, the small peasant economy grew worse. Even notwithstanding the British colonialists are always in favor of the continuance of the small peasant economy in Bengal. Becoming landless was a routine process for the small peasants as consequences of extraction of exorbitant revenue and of impoverishment of farming due to several reasons. Most of the peasants who were once laboring on their own lands had afterwards become landless laborers and began to labor on their erstwhile lands. This means the rural economy got devastated. The question that arises is about how we would interpret Flood Commission's recommendation for our purpose to explain the role of capital and the state in shaping the domain of employment. The Flood's recommendation actually tries to maintenance of a balance between two simultaneous efforts on the part of the state. By recommending for a major agrarian restructuration, the Flood Commission aims at achieving, on the one hand, the goal of capitalist expansion in agriculture, and on the other, the goal of public welfare through granting the cultivators some legal rights to land. The commission realized that the capitalist expansion in agriculture would not be possible unless the cultivators could enjoy a freedom to cultivate their own lands. Upon considering this angle, the Commission's recommendations can be called at best as a part of capitalist agenda. But we didn't get scope to know about the impact of the Flood Commission's recommendation on the capitalist development in agriculture as well as on the peasantry as a whole during the colonial period, since the said report could never manage to get the colonial government's seal on it. The post-colonial rural Bengal thus began its journey, carrying a strong existence of landlessness, indebtedness, and unemployment in the rural landscape, as well as a strong sense of expectations for agrarian prosperity that grew out of India's independence. It is undeniable that agriculture and its growth have expanded and improved all over India due to the implementation of land reform policies in general and the Estate Abolition Act in particular, which were formulated in early post-colonial period, mainly in conceptual line of Flood Commission. But what is truer that the expansion of market as well as of capital has enormously grown as expected owing to the implementation of land reforms during the same period. Flood thus seemed right in his position if we judge the potential of his recommendation from the perspective of capital. However, in our context, interestingly, despite the relative success of land reforms, not only does agriculture become unprofitable, but also do the small peasantry growingly become vulnerable for the very purpose of capital. Actually, capital as well as market gets increasingly thriving ever since the movement of land reforms at the cost of agriculture and of the lives and livelihoods of small peasantry. Through exploiting the input provision and the harvest procurement in agricultural sector, market has become strengthened and capital thereafter gets accumulated at a higher level at the rural grassroots. The application of Green Revolution technology, which is deemed as a dream project by even a section of academics, has not only prompted to increase the application of inputs in cultivation, but also to reduce the fertility of the soil and subsequent slump in production, which anyone can assume once he sets foot in the village. In case of all these major steps on the part of the government in regard to land reform and expansion of agriculture, capital only gains its strength through utilizing the thriving sphere of peasant economy. Interestingly, the capitalist expansion in rural areas in general and the agriculture in particular was once thought to be the solution to the mounting food crisis and poverty that the country faced during the late 1960s. Take, for instance, the GRT. The capitalist expansion has always been made indispensable by the state in this fashion. The narrative of the modern state is, as I argue, the narrative of the capital. Whenever the state faces a major crisis, particularly in employment and food, it opts for further capitalist expansion. It promotes the expansion of capital in such a manner that there is as if no other way to come out from this crisis. For instance, take land acquisition in Singur and Nandigram. The then government even did demonstrate the land acquisition move for industrialization as public interest, as it argues, would create more employments. Whether or not the proposed industrialization would be more of a loss of employment than it helps to create employment has still been a question of contention. But which is more perplexing is the communist exertion of the rhetoric which has been usually nurtured by the dominant propagandist of capital. Both the communists and the liberals are here exerting the same rhetoric that the increase in investment means increase in employment and that the land has to be acquired by any means, whatever action is needed. I would remind the audience once again at this juncture that Marx, like the Bengal communists, had justified the British colonial exploitation in India on the ground that England was causing a social revolution in Hindustan, without which he thought mankind could hardly fulfill its destiny. Although late Marx had begun to rethink his early writings about the British rule in India, it carries little importance to us since the contemporary communists, at least in India, do still reiterate the proposition of early Marx. The Marxists and the liberals, including even the colonialists, do converge here on a major point. The converging point of these two distinct camps is, it seems, the indispensability of the capitalist expansion in economy. The capitalist expansion, these camps believe, must have the potential to push the economy, whatever it may be, towards its higher stage. This stage theory binds into one thread these two camps, though each of them appears as relatively different from each other. While the state has been in action to encourage the capital for forceful expansion through liberalizing India's economy since late 1980s, it cannot afford to overlook dealing with the negative consequences of this new sort of capitalist expansion. The central government has perhaps, for the first time in its half century or so long journey, declared officially that the international political and economic order is being restructured every day, and thus, in many areas of activity, development can best be ensured by freeing them of unnecessary controls and regulations and withdrawing state intervention. I quoted from 8th five-year plan. The 8th five-year plan was thus meant for managing the transition from centrally planned economy to market-led economy. When, as the policymakers recognized in the same document, a third of the country's population lived in abject poverty and unemployment, there was, in point of fact, no end, as many had assumed, that the neoliberal period meant the withdrawal of the state in every respect of the welfare policies on the part of the government. While the earlier policy interventions were such welfare programs that provided tangible services and assets as Gupta and Sharma envisaged, the contemporary policy regime, like the MGNREGA, being an empowerment program, aims at helping the rural to become autonomous rather than dependent clients of the state waiting for the redistribution of resources. I argue that the policies have still been rendering the individuals dependent clients of the state, and thereby it is not the end of welfare and its replacement with workfare, but the simultaneous expansion of both kinds of programs. The strategy of rendering individual subjects responsible entails shifting the responsibility for social risks such as illness, unemployment, poverty, etc., and for life in society to a domain wherein the individual is responsible, and transforming it into a problem of self-care. In the mandate and objectives section of the MGNREGA, it has been mentioned that MGNREGA makes a paradigm shift from the previous one because its design is bottom-up, people-centered, demand-driven, self-selecting, and right-based. Also, it has an integrated natural resource management and livelihood generation perspective. These words clearly reveal that this act as a governmental technology encourages entrepreneurship, which means, in normative sense, any adult individual in rural India make their decisions, pursue their preferences, and seek to maximize the quality of their lives by demanding employment. But while on the one hand, the MGNREGA encourages entrepreneurship, on the other, it limits the sphere of entrepreneurship. The contradiction, in fact, lies in the conceptualization of the act. While it provides the legal guarantee of wage employment on demand and recognizes it to some extent as a right to work, it restricts at the same time the guarantee of employment to only a limited 100 days. Whatever the case may be, one point is clear, that the policies of employment generation are now going to be interpreted and delivered in a different way, and thereby creating a new kind of management of unemployment. However, what is not new is the way the idle labor in rural areas is being used for making both the land and capital productive in the name of employment generation. The question is the way the political parties are going to intervene in employment concern. The political parties of all hues are not different from each other, as well as from the state, as far as the politics of employment are concerned. The politics of the parties are more or less same, for the reason that they do construct their politics on the basis of the grand narrative of the state, which emphasizes on the capital as having a potential to create employment. The narrative, as I have shown, is actually a contradictory narration of two processes, that is the capitalist accumulation and the employment generation. That the expansion of capital, though requires labor as an indispensable component, does inevitably, on the other, counteract the possibility of employment generation, has often been overlooked consciously or unconsciously in this grand narrative. The political parties, it seems, do not bother to see the things beyond this narrative. The unemployment and underemployment that surrounds the rural economy is supposedly being considered by the advocates of various political parties as a normal phenomenon, which, as they believe, would be ameliorated in course of capitalist development. Even the communists, who do at least recognize the capital as a cause of inequality and unemployment, have been reiterating the same practices. Their politics does not manifest any shine of alternate thinking regarding the issues of unemployment. The leaders of these parties do not consider unemployment as a problem, owing probably to the fact that they view the phenomenon of unemployment prevalent in rural areas as normal, or at best, new normal. They do not consider unemployment as a serious problem since, I argue, they do usually belong to the upper class and upper caste groups, and the rural unemployment is a problem experienced by the people who belong mostly to the disadvantaged social groups, the so-called lower class and lower caste and tribal groups, who are none but the vast workforce and service provider engaged by the landholding classes, at least for occasional periods and purposes. Even the urban elite class, as well as the middle class, does also enjoy considerably the cheap labor of the people from these rural disadvantaged groups. Who do want to lose the privilege of parasitic living based on others' labor? Why do the so-called social proprietors bother to recognize the predicament of unemployment that has been experienced by the mass of laboring people who are considered in particular as the subaltern groups in rural parlance, when many from these so-called subaltern groups are unemployed or underemployed for most part of the year? The people of the landholding class in general, as I have observed during my fieldwork, look somewhat dispirited and say that the laboring people have performed such a level economically during the recent period that it is difficult to identify them as belonging to the laboring class. That the laboring people can avail the scope whatsoever beyond farm and non-farm works in rural areas seems has been the concern of the rural elites. In other words, the solvent section of rural people seem to consider it normal that the laboring masses would live in midst of unemployment and the subsequent economic poverty. Hence, the leaders of the political parties who do not even believe that unemployment is a serious and common problem in rural areas are barely expected to consider unemployment being central to their politics. Second, the leaders of the political parties do hardly consider employment as one of their main political goals to achieve, due also to the fact that their politics are essentially being shaped by the ideals of liberalism. Presumes that economic growth would eliminate unemployment automatically. This discourse, as a political viewpoint, set the perspective of capital, which endorses the belief that free market and investment would liberate the people from unemployment and poverty. I argue that the political parties are blind, at least to an extent, to the economic realities of unemployment, since their politics does not go beyond the purview of this dominant discourse. Whether or not there is any scope to go beyond the purview of liberal politics is not our concern here. I have only argued that all the political parties that do a matter in the politics of West Bengal have more or less rehearsing the same discourse since its genesis. In course of their long practice, the leaders of these political parties cease to think of the basic fact that the issues of poverty, whatever its nature may be, have been the outcome of unemployment. They began to nurture a belief that the poverty is a real challenge of governance, and the management of poverty would strengthen the economic development and thus democracy. As a result of this practice, the post-colonial politics continues to focus on the management of poverty only to marginalize the issues of unemployment. If these political parties opt sometimes for tackling unemployment, they would try to do it from the perspective of poverty or its alleviation. We have discussed in my book about the way in which the leaders of the political parties, like on the one hand the Congress Party and on the other the Left Front, to interpret and tackle the issues of unemployment, not only in the same fashion but in a stereotypic way. The Congress Party, while in power both at the center as well as at almost all the states in the initial period, did never endeavor to understand rural unemployment in its fullest sense. Whatever it intended to carry out on employment front in rural areas was not a plan of action to direct attack unemployment. I explained that these interventions were at best an effort of employment generation for a short while with a definite aim of capitalist productivity in agriculture. The capitalist expansion in agriculture that began with the introduction of Green Revolution technology, though initially been helpful to augment in employment, at least for some days seasonally, had been of no use in the long run as far as employment is concerned. While this is the policy in essence of the Congress, insofar as livelihoods and employment are concerned, the left front trod mostly on the heels of the Congress on the issues of rural employment. After examining critically the performance of the left front in the field of rural livelihoods in general and land reforms in particular, I find that the front partners could hardly surpass in its implementation the recommendations made by the Flout Commission. Although the ruling left had utilized the GRT, Green Revolution technology, to accelerate the growth in agriculture and subsequently to create some additional employments in agriculture, it could not keep the increase in production as well as in employment constantly due to some anticipated reasons. The market-dependent agriculture, which did already manifest the signs of obliteration just after a short break, became the worst after the liberalization of Indian economy. The rural economy didn't seem turned around ever since the stagnation. No party seems proved the courage to portray itself as the savior of this rural predicament, particularly on the employment front, while the left front government came up with a more aggressive measure, that is land acquisition for industrialization, only to put the last nail in the coffin of rural unemployment. Needless to say, the rural masses put finally the last nail after more than three decades in the coffin of the left front rule in retaliation against the government's land acquisition move. Making use of the political potentials of the oppositional political parties as well as of the civil society endeavors, the peasantry at large in the state signaled a message that the big high-tech industry, whatever it would promise, it could hardly create employment at the very least for the land loser. However, the party, the ruling party now, the TMC, which got the custody of the state, and in particular its ailing economy, did nothing different from the earlier ruling party as expected as far as rural employment is concerned. It could not perform differently because it too tried to construct its policies basing on the same ideological framework as its predecessors did. The capital-based farming, which had consistently been turned into a loss-making vocation during the last few decades, became thus further worse, only to decrease the opportunities of employment in rural areas. Mechanization in agriculture has put the agricultural laborers out of work, as well as forced migration, and vice versa. While all the political parties did play the same role in opening up the Indian economy to global forces, as all agreed on the basic approach to the economy, a commitment to economic growth, I quoted Kohli, Atul Kohli, and were not in a position to solve the problem of rural unemployment. No party could afford to ignore the predicament of the rural unemployed masses. The parties could not afford to ignore the case of rural unemployed simply for the reason that it might have some political implications. It is undeniable now that the rural unemployed mass who do constitute the major part of the voters are actually the solid base of all kinds of political parties in the rural areas. Therefore, the political parties are always in search of such policies that would manage the consequences of the rural unemployment or as they focus on the poverty. However, these initiatives I have argued, those are undertaken on the part of the parties as well as of the government, has been palliative in nature. What is the role of the civil society? Foucault's discussion of neoliberal governmentality shows, as Lemke argues, that the so-called retreat of the state is in fact prolongation of government. What we observe today is not a diminishment of a reduction or a reduction of the state sovereignty and planning capacities, but a displacement from formal to informal techniques of governments and the appearance of a new actors on the scene of government that indicate fundamental transformation in statehood and a new relation between state and civil society actors. Our context transpires the same phenomenon as theorized by Foucault when it does witness the prolongation of government in the field of welfare with the inclusion of new actors, that is the NGOs, on the scene of government. The state, instead of being in retreat, has been on the go both in planning and in implementation of new kind of techniques and thereby strengthening its structure at the grassroots. The contemporary techniques of the government include formal as well as informal procedures to govern the people in a new fashion. We know that the government of India did exhort formally the NGOs and the so-called civil society in its efforts to transform India since the beginning of post-reform era. Since then, as the policy trends reveal, the government and the market have been complementary with each other, and the government has shown enormous interest to work hand in hand with the non-governmental organization with an aim of making a new India. This new India is having nothing but a pro-business tilt, as told by Atul Kohli, of its state, aimed at, as the scholars perhaps rightly identify, to accelerate the economic growth with a new direction. However, the pro-business tilt of India's state matters a lot as far as unemployment is concerned at the bottom of the society. I'm going time. 10 minutes. Okay. Ten minutes. India, that set out a journey with a new direction since the 1990s, has regularly been to adopt newer measures aiming at welfare as well, only to govern the mass who are prone to unemployment and subsequent poverty in the new situation. While the economic growth has fared well and a new middle class has emerged at the apex as a result of ongoing economic reforms, the people at the grassroots, rural grassroots in particular, have experienced a crisis in the field of employment and other basic security during the same period thanks to economic reforms. To take the responsibility and bear the consequences of its actions, albeit in a limited way, the post-reform state of India has structured a number of policies and acts in collaboration and negotiating with the representatives of the so-called civil society in order to deal with the predicament in the sphere of unemployment and livelihood. The launch of these new measures in policy domain has been interpreted and named in diverse ways: neoliberal governmentality, new welfareism, inclusive growth, etc. Whatever its name may be, the objective is, without a doubt, to manage the issues of unemployment and the loss of livelihoods only with an aim to maintain a status quo, at least in terms of governance. Notwithstanding its failure to make any difference on the employment front, these measures must have some implication in political terms. The political implications are such that the means of welfare has begun to be thought as the goal of the policies by a section of concerned stakeholders. For instance, take the MGNREGA. While there is hardly any assurance of right in this said act, the protagonists do try to demonstrate it as a right to employment. The policy interventions on the part of the government are such effective, particularly in popular discursive field, that the causes of the rural districts do appear blurred or become a non-issue. The people at large who are concerned that India's rural districts, while seeing immense potential in the Employment Guarantee Act, are otherwise least bothered about the causes of unemployment. What is the future? What is the future trend of this all processes? Owing to the devastating crisis in agriculture and overall rural economy, and the subsequent out-migration of the male members of rural families in search of jobs, the women are conspicuous by their presence in agriculture. The more the male members flee the rural landscape, the more the women get hold the vocation of agriculture. This is to say, agriculture, and in particular, small-scale agriculture, become women's enterprise. Instead of indicating a positive trend, the feminization of agriculture signifies a grave insecurity that emerging in the said sphere. The question that arises is the way these processes are going to shape the rural economy. This means, what is the future of rural economy? In concrete term, is there any prospect to transform the rural economy towards a better future in terms of equal opportunities in rural employment? What kinds of economic policies are required to curb the rural distress? Do the welfare policies have any role to play in supplementing the rural livelihoods in India? I would like to merge all these aforesaid questions into one single major question. How do we imagine essaying an alternate politics which with an aim to compel the post-colonial state to adopt a strategy for effectively regulating the capitalist expansion with a skew to employment? An instant answer is, simply put, the government has to withdraw the neoliberal project, which ensures unfettered freedom of the market, and put into place instead the embedded liberalism. While the neoliberal project calls for the state's withdrawal from economy, the embedded liberalism endorses that states should be freely deployed in market processes to achieve the ends like full employment and the welfare of the citizens. However, the system of embedded liberalism alone can't ensure full employment and welfare of the citizens in a country unless a conscious effort made on the part of the concerned citizens to give employment as a priority over other issues. I have sought the way the issues of economic growth were prioritized even during the pre-neoliberal period in India. In the name of enhancement of economic growth, the capital has always dominated the labor without a minimal compromise with labor. Some sorts of compromise between capital and labor are the prerequisite for the guarantee of employment for all. Instead of focusing on the issues of investment and economic growth, employment has to be a main focus of attention in all policies. Within the limit of liberal framework, this is the only option which the future policymakers could pursue in order to construct a better economic planning for ensuring equal employment opportunities. However, there is hardly any sharp distinction between the so-called two economies, corporate economy and the non-corporate economy, as all employment. As proposed by the scholars, while the corporate economy is defined as a space of accumulation of capital, the non-corporate economy is, as they imagine, as a space of the subordinate classes for their mere survival. The non-corporate space, or the need economy, I argue, is also a vibrant space for exorbitant accumulation of capital. Rather, this space is more prone to capitalist exploitation due to the lack of any effective state regulation. To sum up, the regulation of market processes by the state and a clear focus on full employment in every policy is utmost necessary so as to make the country free of poor. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Roy, for a very interesting and insightful talk with very, very interesting theoretical questions and also empirical questions. Any questions and comments from the audience? Anything you'd like to ask Dr. Roy? Yes, please.
Hello, thank you for the very interesting presentation. Vanessa Perez from Ibero in Mexico City.
I completely hear your argument around the capitalism and how it has manipulated labor and so on and so forth, but I'm wondering in the future if you see employment as a precondition of a good life in all cases. So because there's a current counter theory to that in for example healthy ecosystems in which you can actually create social enterprises that don't have any type of employment structures. So they're more like the previous community-based exchange economies, like small economies. So do you actually see that as a precondition of employment, as a precondition of a good life in the rural areas?
This which economy you can say, pardon?
So I'm thinking about probably I didn't completely understand your definition of employment, maybe. So what do you mean by employment then in the rural areas? And if there's a formality aspect to it, and then if it is for you a precondition of a good life,
Yes, no, actually, employment means work, and work for wage, or you can say self-employment, mm-hmm. that you can lead a good life. You can actually get hold of the resources which you need, which a man or woman needs to survive. So this may be the self-employment, some small community-based endeavor, some cooperative, anything. But I want to mean employment as something which ensures the life of the people for survival. This is anything, not formal employment or some kind of wage employment, anything. The work to earn resources for living, for survival.
First, we have the gentleman behind Harji.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Onsika Kabasi Etum from Department of Agri-Economics and Extension, University of Uyo, Nigeria. You mentioned that poverty is, there is more focus on poverty reduction than unemployment reduction in India from your lecture. Government is focusing more on poverty reduction than unemployment, if I understand you clearly. Now, you know very well that why most policies and programs of government in the developing economies have failed is that they use the top-bottom approach to development issues, where policies and programs are decided at the top and then sent down to the bottom. Now, I don't know whether the Indian government has involved the poor in welfare policies and unemployment and poverty reduction and poverty. That is, whether they have involved the poor in formulating policies that will reduce poverty and unemployment, because if you must reduce poverty, I strongly believe that the poor should be involved in policies and programs, because this, those that wear the shoes knows where it pinches. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. Actually, I tried to argue that what do we mean by poverty? This is my main focus. Why don't we actually start from unemployment? This was my focus. If we focus on this thing, then we can chalk out a better program to alleviate what you call poverty. My perspective is somewhat different. Why don't we focus on unemployment? Why we are focusing on poverty? What is poverty? I don't know. I don't have any meaning. What is poverty? Because people do not have the resources. What are those resources? From where we can get it? I wanted to focus on it in the rural areas. People do not have land. People do not have some other resources to make a living. So we just argued with Anand and Sripa that that people in India, actually in India, villages are running towards city. All the people, you can say that on the trains, that in the early morning, they actually migrate to the cities for some informal construction work, some other works for maid servant. Many women are working as maid servant in Kolkata. Everybody has, every family, some lower middle class has also a maid servant, you know? It's very peculiar. For it, just very minimum wages. So, actually, these non-farm works are too actually not substantial for making a good life. Farm work and non-farm work, both are very insecure in the rural areas. I try to focus on it, actually.
We're running out of time, so perhaps okay. I'll take Dr. Anand's question next.
Well, one comment. Other states have bypassed West Bengal for two reasons. That's a pure empirical thing. One, more clear land reforms based on consolidation of holdings. Mm-hmm. Consolidation of holdings did not take place in West Bengal the way it took place in Punjab and some other states. So your land reforms were stunted. Very small pieces of land going. The other was that when you look at this tautological discussion between employment and poverty reduction, basically the focus is on through poverty alleviation, you're trying to create employments. So until you change the land structure, the ownership relations, which were bypassed, until you do consolidation of holdings so that the holdings are large enough to give that prosperity to the rural areas, and until you bring in rural industries to supplement that income, the whole debate whether we say poverty is less or employment should be more, we are playing. And the question is, you made a distinction between neoliberalism and embedded liberalism. Yeah. Could you define embedded liberalism a little more?
Professor Anand, it's very quite interesting, actually, the land reform. Actually, we celebrate the land reform of West Bengal. Many people celebrate the land reforms of West Bengal because the communists did a very good thing as far as land reform is concerned. But it is not what you said, consolidated land reform.
It didn't take place.
And another is that what you told, that rural industries is completely, it didn't appear. There is no rural industry, very, very few. Why? Actually, I have argued in my book, because of this, I can give you an example. You know the puff rice, muri, puff rice. Many women in the village areas, they just fried this puff rice and they sell it out in the market. But recently, while actually I did my field work, I have seen there is a puff rice factory. One entrepreneur, he has established a puff rice industry. So all women, they become jobless, you know? So how do you choke out the labor-intensive industries in the rural areas? This is my point. Why don't we focus on employment in industry, in farming, in non-farming, whatever may be the job or vocation. But if we focus on employment, then it will be just a good thing for the society. And what is embedded capitalism? I wanted to focus, actually. I tried to explain in David Harvey's explanation. In embedded capitalism, the state intervenes the market in a stronger way. But in neoliberal phase, state declares in its policies, I quote it, that market runs. This is the stage of market. We have to work hand in hand with the market. And state is just withdrawing itself.
But it's just to give you another empirical fact, you know, procurement of wheat and rice, that's done by administered prices. So you ensure that the farmer gets his price. In other places, he's quite wealthy. But in West Bengal, because his farm is so small, because you didn't consolidate...
There is no organization of the farmers also.
So he earns, even though it is state regulation of prices, that the prices don't crash as they crash for, let's say, coffee in Brazil or for some other rubber in some states of Africa... You do have administered prices for grains.
You know.
But because the farms are so small.
Actually, when I did my field work, the farmers are always complaining that we do not have any association, farmers association like in Punjab, in Haryana, in UP. We do not bargain with the government. We do not bargain with the big industrialist, big holders. So they are not getting the remunerative price of their crops. This is one thing. And second thing is procurement price is fixed by the government. But this doesn't work. This doesn't work for so many reasons. Some bureaucratic things are there. People are not interested to go to the places where government is purchasing the crops. There are some hurdles. They are not actually achieving it. They have very little access. But in this regime, in the present government, I do not know what is the actual condition of this procurement price. But government has tried to do something, the fixed procurement price, and then I don't know, actually.
The second is access to markets.
I think we'll go in. It's a very interesting discussion now, but because we need to get to our panel sessions, and I thank you so much, Dr. Roy. It gave rise to a vigorous debate.
Thank you.
That's always very good.